Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, June 17th, 2025. We begin on the front page with Bentland talks pride in Bloomington Normal. Prairie Pride Coalition President discusses LGBTQ plus support efforts by Matus Janik. For more than 30 years, Dave Bentland has been working with others in the community to support and promote the rights of the LGBTQ plus community. In honor of National Pride Month, Bentland discussed his long career spanning from his time at Illinois State University, which included several different roles over his 37 years there, to the present, and his work with the Prairie Pride Coalition, a not-for-profit organization, quote, dedicated to equality for LGBTQIA plus community in Bloomington Normal and McLean County. He also shared what pride means for residents of Bloomington Normal and across central Illinois. That means creating an environment where people feel safe, where they feel valued, where they feel included, all of those things. We've tried hard to build an environment that like that in Bloomington Normal over the past 30 years that the Prairie Pride Coalition has been in existence, and we've done that in a number of ways. Through lobbying efforts that have brought about policies and laws that are more just and more socially conscious of the diversity of our community, we've brought it about through community outreach, creating social activities and events like Pride Fest. These things are all done with an end goal of making this a community where people feel like they are part of the community. And I'm talking about the larger Bloomington Normal community, where they feel like they can be productive, safe, and valued as citizens. The next question is, how can a person be an ally during Pride Month and any time of the year? There are a number of ways. Bentland says, we offer a resource called the Bloomington Normal Area LGBTQIA plus Business and Resource Directory that's an opportunity for businesses, houses of worship, organizations, and social service agencies here in the community to sign on to pledge to be a safe and welcoming environment. If you go around town, you'll see our circular decal in a lot of windows and doors of those businesses and houses of worship. And that's a way for us to identify those allies in our community, but it's also a way for them to openly exhibit their support for the community because that's more important than ever. These days, we have a number of things that we do throughout the year that help people be allies, including allyship trainings through a local counselor here, and that person works with our allies in the community because a lot of people feel that they're allies, and they are, but we try to give them the tools they need to be better allies. There are a couple of ways that we try to build that allied community because we've always said that as a minority group, we are a very small group, and whatever we accomplish cannot be accomplished alone. We need allies, so I think this day and age, our allies are more important than ever, and so we value them, and we try to do things that provide them the opportunity to be a better ally for us. How long has the Prairie Pride Coalition been active, and what services do you provide? The Prairie Pride Coalition began in 1995, strictly as an organization working to get the ordinances in Bloomington Normal amended to include sexual orientation protection in employment and housing and public accommodation in a number of different areas. We started off as an activist organization, and eventually those ordinances were updated and we won some victories on the state level in terms of other legislative actions. At some point, we decided that we wanted to expand our scope as an organization. We started doing a lot more community outreach activities, ways that we can build up this local community and make it safer, more equitable place through programming, through projects that address concerns of specific sectors of our LGBTQIA plus community. Over the years, we've adjusted in response to the needs of our community, and we're in our 30th year. At this point, we're planning for the next 10 years, and we're getting ready to release a community needs assessment to our community and our allies. This assessment will give them the opportunity to give us feedback on what we're doing as an organization and what they feel are the needs and the challenges that our community faces and how we might be better able to help meet those needs. When did you realize it was time to step away and retire from Illinois State University? Bentland says, when I retired back at the end of 2022, it felt like the right time. Society was beginning to come out of COVID, and we had gone through a couple of really hard years. And I hit the magical 6-0 number, and it just felt like the right time to do that. I knew that it would also give me an opportunity to maybe ramp up my involvement a little bit in community organizations like Prairie Pride Coalition and our Central Illinois chapter of ACLU. So I felt like the time was right, and I sensed that the need was there, and several of my fellow board members on the Prairie Pride Coalition are in the same situation. So we're able to devote a good bit more time than we did before on these issues to try and improve things in our community. It's made a big difference, and I think what I like about working with the Prairie Pride Coalition is that we do have a seasoned board that is very diverse and represents many of the sectors of our LGBTQIA+ community. So when we work together as a board, we make sound decisions and we have the interests of our community in mind. On a personal level, I feel very fortunate. I had a great time at ISU. I learned a lot. I had several very important mentors who helped me along the way, and without them, I'm not sure where I would be. What motivates you to keep advocating for the LGBTQIA+ community? I believe that many of our board members, including myself, have a genuine passion for this. It's something that's been ingrained into us. Many of the board members have been involved in local causes for 30 to 40 years, and I'm among those. On a personal level, I grew up in a household that cared about issues. My family was not active in the way I'm active today, but they had great empathy and cared about people when they saw injustice. They spoke up about it, so that always stuck with me and sort of drives me today. Bentland says, also, like I said before, those mentors who have demonstrated to me through their actions just how important this work is, and I think those sorts of things stick with me in my memory and remind me how valuable it is. Growing up as a gay kid in a rural town, you experience a good bit of bullying and discrimination. And I think with a lot of us, it's a matter of remembering those things, but using them in a positive way and giving back to make sure that maybe this generation and future generations will have a better situation when they're growing up as kids. There's a number of motivations that all of us think about when we get involved with these organizations and do the work that is needed in the community. What do you do with your spare time? Do you have any hobbies? I have a sister who lives here in Bloomington, so I do spend good quality time with her, and that provides me an opportunity for time away from some of the issues and the stressors that are going on in our world today. I would say the same thing about my daughter. My daughter is a great inspiration to me, and there are times when we get together and I'm feeling frustrated and hopeless and down that she is there for me and is a blessing in my life. I rely on my family ties for support and relaxation. I've lived in this community since 1980, so I've really developed a good circle of friends who I can go to and share a drink with and just relax to get away from things. Is there an accomplishment or moment that you're most proud of in your life? Bentland says that the students and the group of people who have at ISU who were able to help with the LGBTQ+ Student Support Fund over the years. This is a fund that was created back in the early 2000s, which is probably getting near 25 years old now, that was created for students who lost the emotional and financial support of their families after they came out as gay, bisexual, and transgender. In many cases, those students were in danger of having to drop out because they had no financial support there any longer. I look at that as something that we as a collective community came together and we have made a difference in keeping many such students in school to finish their degrees and to go on and do the work that a lot of us are doing today. They're giving back, they got their degrees, and that fund at ISU has just grown and grown and grown over the years. And it's a testament to this community that there are so many people who have donated to the fund and that the funds are available to help those students today. I think that is something I will always appreciate about what we as a community have been able to do and what I've been able to be a part of. Is there anything else you would want to share about Pride Month or in general about Bloomington Normal? And Bentland says, you know, it's commonly referred to as Pride Month, but I would say that here in Central Illinois, it extends to become Pride Summer, because last month we had Pride Fest in Springfield. This month we have Pride Fest in Lincoln, Pride Fest in Ottawa, and of course we have the Pride Festival and Parade in Chicago. Next month is the Bloomington Normal Pride Fest, so the sense of pride extends beyond just one month, and we also have other notable days and months during the year as well. October is LGBTQ History Month, and we've used that opportunity in the past as a way to educate and inform people about our history, which these days is quite honestly in danger because certain parts of our community are being erased from the history books and from our national monuments. We commemorate World AIDS Day on December 1st, and this past February we commemorated Black History Month because so many of the figures from Black history who are notable also intersected with the LGBTQIA+ community. Bentland says, I think it's really easy in some way to look at whatever day of the year you're in and find some connection to the community, and that's what we try to do, is to keep that feeling of pride and allyship and support going throughout the entire year through any number of different activities and projects we work on. Pride Month is a wonderful thing, and it's crazy full of stuff going on, but at the same time, it's a feeling that we hope to extend into the entire year. In other local news, we have 12-year-old dies in bike versus car crash by Donette Beckett. A 12-year-old Decatur boy has died after he was hit by a car while riding his bike. The boy has been identified as Kavari Drisdell by Macon County Coroner Michael D. Burkham. The GoFundMe has been created to help the family with funeral expenses. In the request, Kavari's mother praised the boy for the strength he had shown battling asthma since he was a baby. He was a student at Robertson Charter School, and the school counselor, Devin Fields, is available for students who need help processing the news. Call the school at 217-428-7072. The driver of the vehicle was arrested for aggravated driving under the influence of alcohol causing death. According to a news release by the Decatur Police Department, officers were dispatched at approximately 5 p.m. on Sunday to the intersection of North Van Dyke and West King Street in reference to a motor vehicle crash involving a bicyclist. The initial investigation revealed that the bicyclist traveled eastbound across North Van Dyke Street at West King Street and was struck by a 2011 Dodge Challenger, Sergeant Brett Hill reported. The cyclist was transported to a local hospital by ambulance where he was later pronounced deceased. The driver, excuse me, who did not receive any injuries is a 45-year-old Decatur man. Members of the fatal accident investigation team responded to the scene and continued to investigate this crash. Drew Zimmerman writes, ISU Economic Department hosting summer program. The Illinois State University and Constellation in Normal are teaming up to provide a one-of-a-kind summer program for local students called Smart Choices, Empowering Future Leaders in Energy and Sustainability. This energy boot camp is designed to educate students and teachers on all aspects of energy. Participants will gain firsthand knowledge of the future of energy through field trips to wind and solar farms, power plants, water treatment facilities, natural gas plants, nuclear power plants, and electric vehicle facilities. The program runs from August 4th to 8th and is free for all selected students and teachers. Transportation, lodging, and food will be included. Smart Choices was made possible by a grant from Constellation to educate students on energy, environment, and sustainability issues. Whether you're a student mapping out your career or a teacher shaping the next generation, this experience will be transformative. The future won't wait, and neither should you. Seize this incredible opportunity to jumpstart your journey as a leader in energy and sustainability, boot camp organizers said in their news release. Instructors and students are invited to apply at tinyurl.com/ISU Constellation. The program is designed for high school students, but middle schoolers are also welcome to apply. The deadline is July 20th. For additional information, you can email economics@ilstu.edu. In state news, we have Chicago Transit Agency's Brace for Doomsday Funding Scenario by Andrew Adams with Capital News, Illinois. Transit agency officials in Chicagoland met last week and formally began the process of planning for next year's budget, including drawing up plans for major service cuts and potential layoffs. It's the latest chapter in an ongoing fight between public transit officials and state lawmakers over funding. Public Transportation Agency's federal COVID-19 relief funds are set to run out in 2026. Despite the funding, ridership on buses and trains still hasn't reached pre-pandemic levels. Now, transit agencies running buses and trains in northern Illinois are facing a $771 million annual combined budget gap, and lawmakers did not pass funding reform legislation by a critical May 31st deadline. Well, House Speaker Emmanuel Chris Welch told Capital News Illinois last week that lawmakers have time to handle the situation. Transit officials told a very different story at two meetings this week. "We have told everyone they needed to act by May 31st or else," Regional Transportation Authority Board Member Tom Kotarek said at a board meeting on Thursday. "We are in the or else phase." Officials at the RTA laid out a plan Thursday to handle the monetary uncertainty, create two budgets. In one scenario, budget planners assume the gap is filled and agencies can move forward with the rough plan approved late last year. "But we cannot operate on assumptions and pledges of good faith and promises. We just can't, legally," RTA Government Affairs Director Rob Nash said. The RTA board formally asked the agencies it oversees, the Chicago Transit Authority, Metro Commuter Rail, and Pace Suburban Bus, to prepare a budget that assumes no new funding from Springfield before the end of the year. This means a roughly 20% reduction from what the agency expected. Multiple RTA officials called it the doomsday scenario. RTA Chief Financial Officer Kevin Busso said it would require catastrophic cuts. CTA Acting President Nora Learson told the CTA board on Wednesday that it was severe and sobering for all of us and hard to stomach. Under both plans, the RTA would institute fare increases in 2026 and administrative efficiencies to reduce costs in 2025. The RTA also plans to create an ad hoc task force to plan cuts and manage the year's unusual budget process. The austerity measures are not just a piece of political theater. The RTA, under state law, must tell service boards the amount of revenue that will be available to them by September 15th each year, and the boards must submit individual budgets based on that revenue. The oversight agency releases preliminary funding amounts for transit planners to use months earlier in July. Learson said the CTA will continue to operate with its current 2025 service plan, but that over the summer and into the fall, the agency will hold public hearings to more specifically consider the consequences of the fiscal cliff. The September deadline is 3 weeks before the General Assembly's fall session begins, the earliest that lawmakers are scheduled to meet. But even if lawmakers meet in October and pass funding reform, officials said that missing their spring deadline has already guaranteed harmful effects. "I don't want to give anyone false hope that there is still any way to avoid some of these negative impacts," RTA Executive Director Leanne Redden said. "The negative impacts are here, and now we're going to have to all work together to mitigate the worst of those impacts for as long as possible while the legislature continues to do their work." Even if lawmakers pass a new funding mechanism, because of the time it takes to implement new policies, that money might not become available to transit agencies until next summer, either due to far-off effective dates on any new laws or the delays of implementing new policies. Delays in funding would, according to Nash, impose costs, financial and otherwise, to the system and to riders. We are likely to face a challenge in the first part of 2026, no matter what the General Assembly does at this point, Nash said during the Thursday RTA board meeting. Over the past year, several proposals have been pitched in Springfield to address problems in Chicagoland transit agencies. Two major proposals come from a coalition of environmentalists and labor unions. On Thursday, representatives of the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition and Labor Alliance for Public Transportation, two groups that have occasionally disagreed on how to address transit agencies' woes, released a joint statement. The groups said the RTA's Thursday meeting unveiled the disastrous consequences of Springfield's inaction and called for lawmakers to meet this summer to address the problem. We cannot wait any longer. The General Assembly needs to avert further disaster and address the transit fiscal cliff with reforms and dedicated revenue, while working with existing agencies to ensure that we are investing in the future of our transit systems. The time to act is now, the group said. While no proposal received close to the support it needed this spring, one bill made it through the Senate in the final hours of lawmakers' legislative session. That bill would have instituted several reforms that had been broadly agreed on, although not unanimously. Certain provisions laying out the balance of power on various boards were opposed by local governments. Its funding mechanism, however, ignited quick controversy. The provision that sparked the greatest opposition would have instituted a $1.50 tax on package deliveries, except on orders of groceries and medicines. That provision drew near immediate opposition from businesses and interest groups with influential networks of lobbyists. The major tech lobbying group, TechNEC, along with Uber, Instacart, DoorDash, Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, and several retail industry groups registered their opposition. The bill was not considered in the House, and no bill with a similar funding mechanism was proposed in that chamber. Paula Worthington, an economist and senior lecturer at the University of Chicago, told Capital News Illinois that imposing a new tax like the delivery fee would be difficult. That is a heavy lift, procedurally and legally, Worthington said. You can't just wave a magic wand. Worthington pointed to other states' systems of transit funding that typically include some elements of shared burden. Other states have implemented a commuter transportation mobility tax on certain businesses, taxes on road users, or expanding taxes on ride-sharing companies. Worthington said Illinois could consider those or other taxes during discussions over the summer to identify a solution. But those discussions now need to be out in the public, Worthington said. And back on the first page, we have A Guide to Juneteenth Celebrations by Terry Tang. It was 160 years ago that enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned they were freed after the Civil War's end and 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. The resulting Juneteenth holiday, its name combining June and 19th, has only grown in 1.5 centuries. In 2021, President Joe Biden designated it a federal holiday, expanding its recognition beyond Black America. This year will be the first Juneteenth under President Donald Trump's second administration, which banned diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or DEI, in the federal government. This included removing Black American history content from federal websites. Trump officials also discouraged some federal agencies from recognizing other racial heritage celebrations. Still, many people anticipating getting Juneteenth off of work. There are a plethora of street festivals, fairs, concerts, and other events planned throughout the week leading into the holiday. But with the current political climate, some may wonder if their company will honor it. I don't think anyone should be intimidated or obligated into not celebrating the day, said Mark Morial, president and CEO of the National Urban League. I've not heard of anyone being denied. I think it would be absolutely reprehensible. People who never gave the occasion more than a passing thought may be asking themselves, is there a right way to celebrate it? For beginners and those who are brushing up on history, here are some answers. Is Juneteenth more of a solemn day of remembrance or a party? It depends on what you want. Juneteenth festivals are rooted in cookouts and picnics. Originally celebrated as Black Americans' true Independence Day, outdoor events allowed for large, raucous reunions among formerly enslaved family, many of whom had been separated. The gatherings were especially revolutionary because they were free of restrictive measures, known as Black Codes, enforced by Confederate states. Codes controlled whether liberated slaves could vote, buy property, gather for worship, and other aspects of their daily life. Last year, the White House kicked things off early with a concert on the South Lawn for Juneteenth and Black Music Month. The atmosphere was primarily festive, with Vice President Kamala Harris, the first Black Vice President, dancing on stage with gospel singer Kirk Franklin. Plans for a Juneteenth event or proclamation this year have not been decided, according to the White House press office. Others may choose to treat it as a day of rest and remembrance. That can mean doing community service, attending an education panel, or taking time off. The most important thing everyone should do is be able to quickly answer the question, what is Juneteenth? As for what kind of public events are taking place, you can search online and you will find gatherings nationwide varying in scope and tone, from festivals, parades, and concerts to more educational events and panel discussions. Events in Bloomington on Thursday include a special story time and musical performance with crafts and activities from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Public Library at 205 East Olive Street. The city's annual Juneteenth celebration will then be held from 11:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 21st in Miller Park at 1020 South Morris Avenue. A full list of Central Illinois' June 10th events can be found at bit.ly/pantographjuneteenth25 online. And the National Park Service has said it is again making entry into all sites free on the holiday. And with that, we conclude the reading of part one of the pantograph for Tuesday, June 17th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with part two.